Welcome, listeners. You're tuned in to the People's History Project podcast, run by Oprah Kingston, a student-run group with a focus on research, education, and direct action on intersectional matters of social and environmental justice. Before we begin, content warnings for this episode include discussions addressing misogynistic attitudes around sexual assault on campus. We would also like to acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded at CFRC at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land. It is our collective responsibility to address the systematic oppression that Indigenous people face and contribute to meaningful reconciliation and direct action, especially in light of the topic of this episode and the related issue that sexualized violence disproportionately affects more Indigenous women. And so, please donate to or support organizations that advocate care and justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women across Turtle Island. If you or a loved one need to reach out for local help, Sexual Assault Center Kingston is a nonprofit organization providing free, confidential, non-judgmental support for all survivors and takes a trauma-informed, intersectional approach to their work. Learn more on their sackingston.com website. The People's History Project aims to recognize and preserve the important roles that Kingstonians and Queen's students have played in many social movements throughout the years. The stories of people who participated in struggles for social and environmental justice, queer, Indigenous, Black, anti-racist, feminist, among many others, often go untold in official histories. The PHP seeks to engage with these stories by making accessible the rich history of social movements and resistance in Kingston. So if you've ever been curious about how Kingston as we know it came to be, you are listening to the right podcast. Today we are talking about how a vulgar act of misogyny on Queen's campus led to one of the greatest pushes for sexual assault activism and the installation of the blue safety lights across campus. It all started in early October 1989, when a group of male students put several derogatory signs up on the windows of their dorms in Gord Brock to mock the No Means No campaign. The signs that were made clearly visible to pedestrians and passerbys read, "No means kick her in the teeth. No means harder. No means tie me up. No means more beer. No means dyke. No means down on your knees, bitch." When the journal tried to interview some third floor Gord residents, they claimed that their messages were merely a joke. They explained that they wanted to lighten up the rape awareness campaign and did this because of the overwhelming amount of info and pamphlets they got about date rape throughout the campaign. It seemed this group of guys learned nothing from the pamphlets. The backlash was immediate. Students at McNeil, the all-female residents across the street, put up signs that read, "No means no," "End misogyny now," and "No means it's too small." Outraged by the students' misogyny and the university's lack of response, a group of female students banded together to create ROFF, the Radical Obnoxious Fucking Feminists. This group fought against these misogynistic attacks vigilantly, spray-painting No Means No and ROFF's watching on the pavement outside the residences around Leonard Field. An open letter to the Queen's community from the group describing their complaints in detail appeared in an on-campus publication called Surface. It reads, "As a group of concerned women, we have felt compelled to respond to the blatantly misogynist attitudes and actions occurring on this campus. Attitudes and actions that encourage violence against women, and that this university has responded to with silence. As women within the structure of a university, many of us have tried to combat the violence, as well as the silence, through the official channels of protest provided by this university. And while we recognize the value of using these routes, we also feel that there are some things that require immediate and direct action. In response to the policy of silence perpetuated by this university regarding the symbolic and literal acts of violence against women on this campus, we, as a group of women, take full responsibility for the following actions." The letter also listed actions that the group claimed as their own, including reclaiming the speed bump outside Clark Hall Pub, formerly referred to by the Queen's engineers as the Golden Tit, removing nursing uniforms from trees and lampposts that were covered in derogatory and sexist slogans such as "No More Dykes on Bikes" and "All Men-Hating Feminists Need Are Good Fucks from Engineers," and the spray-painted signs on the sidewalks that read "No Means No" and "ROFF's Watching." More signs appeared in the windows of Gordon, Brockington, Leonard, McNeil, and Morris residences until the Dean of Women demanded that they be taken down. By October 13 of 1989, all of the messages had been removed from the windows, and attempts at reparation by the school began. Dons in Gordon House chose to host a Gender Issues Awareness Week for members of the AMS Gender Issues Committee and representatives from the Women's Center could organize workshops and discussions regarding rape and sexual assault. The main campus residence council did not punish the Gord 3 residents involved, even after a letter from the Arts and Science Undergraduate Society encouraging them to do so. Then Queen's University became the center of a media storm when the Toronto Star published a front-page article about the misogynistic signs. Over the next few days, regional newspapers such as the Whig Standard picked up the story and national news outlets like the CBC broadcast discussions on the radio program as it happens. The 9 residents of Gordon House who posted the original signs in their windows sent a letter to both the Toronto Star and the Whig apologizing for their actions. The apologies were criticized by a number of students who wrote letters to the editor of the journal. One such letter questioned the boys' motives for writing the apology, stating, "But what was the apology for? Who was the apology really aimed at? Are those responsible for the Gordon House signs truly sorry because of who they offended, or are they sorry that they got caught? Evidence clearly points to the latter. Ask yourself, if they are truly sorry, why did it take national media coverage to prompt this apology?" The opinion section of the journal was flooded with letters expressing tremendously polarized views on the signs, the boys involved, ROFF, and the media storm that had broken out. During the scandal, some people also criticized Queen's administration for their inaction regarding both the signs as well as the issue of sexual assault on campus, pointing out Principal David Smith's notable silence. Fed up with his lack of response, on November 9, 30 women clad in scarves to obscure their identities marched into Principal Smith's office to stage a sit-in. Surface published an article signed 5 of a group of women that stated the members of the sit-in were not associated with ROFF, the Women's Center, or the Gender Issues Committee, and that some women involved probably wouldn't call themselves feminists. Surface also reported that one observer made an off-the-cuff comment to a news photographer at the sit-in, saying, "Go ahead and take all of the pictures that you want of those fucking feminist bitches so that we know exactly who they are so that we can rape them." Over 100 women were involved in the sit-in, and a group of men supported by keeping vigil on the steps outside. Now that's how to be a feminist ally, using their privilege and physical power to protect and support the movement. According to the journal, a spokesperson for the group of women read out a list of 7 demands, stating that, "We, the women of Queens, protest the misogyny of some of the men on this campus and the refusal of the Queens administration to take action and speak out against this violence." The demands included an investigation of Orientation Week and Homecoming, for the MCRC to be stripped of autonomy, for the position of the Dean of Women to be maintained, for further educational campaigns on sexual assault, for the Gordon House men to raise a minimum of $5,000 to go to organizations like Interval House that help women, for Principal Smith to make a public statement denouncing the actions of the Gordon House men, and that the administration provide funds for Kingston's Sexual Assault Crisis Center. The journal reported that Smith responded by stating that he had written a letter to the journal denouncing the actions in Gordon House, but the women challenged his delay in making a public statement about the signs. The journal reported that Smith claimed the judicial processes in place at the school made it impossible for him to take further action beyond his personal statement, and that the chair of Queen's Senate can only respond to AMS Judicial Committee cases when they are referred to him by recommendations of the committee. The women expressed their frustration with the judicial system, with one person stating, "We don't have faith in the system. The judicial system at Queen's is not going to stop the assaults." I found a phrase coined by Alex V. Green, conversational industrial complex. It stalls real progress by rehashing conversations in circles. Nothing gets done and should be remedied by direct action. Leading task forces and following due processes doesn't make sense if it never even fixes the bad behavior happening. Another woman at the time said the following, "I have a right to study safely. I have a right to live without fear. You cannot understand the fear. You are not always looking for the safest place to walk. You don't know what it's like to be scared." Principal Smith did call for the Principal's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women to perform a review of Orientation Week and Homecoming. He also confirmed that the position of Dean of Women would remain and said he would look into funding the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. Funding of $10,000 was eventually donated in the new year. Smith, however, continued to insist that the women follow established procedures. After 29 hours, the women emerged from Principal Smith's office. Before leaving, the spokesperson for the group announced from a second floor of Richardson Hall that, "We are leaving because we feel we have succeeded in making this an urgent, immediate, and serious concern." According to the journal, over the course of the sit-in, some of the women involved in or associated with the sit-in received harassing phone calls, and some women were confronted on the street when walking home. One woman told the journal that one caller had apologized for what had happened and claimed that he had done empirical studies in his women's study class, which showed that, according to him, women scratch men's backs when they're having sex not because women enjoy sex, because they don't. It's because they want to get back at men for dominating them, for being on top. When tragedy struck Montreal on Wednesday, December 6, 1989, it acted as a wake-up call for universities across the country to face the rampant misogyny on campus. During the Montreal massacre, Marc Lepine entered the École Polytechnique and murdered 14 women, claiming he was fighting feminism and blamed feminists for his problems. At Queen's University, memorials are held, the principal and other officials made public statements expressing their condolences, and students grappled with the ramifications of this incident. The journal reported that 27 buildings on campus were spray-painted with feminist slogans. Alumni expressed their frustration in letters written to both the journal and administration. On December 1, Queen's alumni and former principal Daniel R. Wolfe wrote a letter to the editor that was published in the journal prior to the massacre, criticizing the administration's lack of response. "Much of the actual behavior of the residence men involved in this incident, which I recognize was likely only a small minority, it sickens me, and as much as it did so 14 years ago as an undergraduate, I am more shocked by the apparent indifference shown by Principal Smith and the administration of Queen's in refusing to take a firm stance against such incidents, other than eventually having the signs removed. Both of us enjoyed our years as students at Queen's, and have always hoped that our daughter might study there eventually. But unless things change very much in the next few years, we would have a hard time recommending the Queen's undergraduate experience to her. The administration of Queen's University must take a firm stance against sexual harassment of this kind. It is with deep regret that I must say that until it does so, we will be unable to participate in any alumni fund drives, and will encourage other alumni to do likewise." Similarly, on January 16, two brothers, both alumni, expressed concern about the state of women on Queen's campus, understandably worried about their sister who was still a student. Their letter, published in the journal, explained their position. "To demonstrate our support for the silence, we submit to you our check to the Alumni Annual Fund for $0.00. We will remain abreast of the situation through our sister, and if the environment on campus improves, we will consider augmenting the contribution substantially. We rest concerned personally with the future of Queen's." The attention of Queen's alumni had clearly been attracted, and action was being taken to demonstrate their displeasure. On January 30, the AMS Judicial Committee, composed of three men to preside over the hearing, adjourned the trial of the Gordon House Nine. The students were accused of violating the university's code of conduct, as well as the AMS and MCRC constitutions, by putting signs in their windows. According to the journal, the defendants hired a lawyer who claimed that his clients had not had sufficient time to prepare the case. In early February, a judge from the Supreme Court of Ontario granted an injunction, ruling that the judicial committee must wait until March 15 before hearing the case. The lawyer informed the journal that the committee lacked jurisdiction to hear the case since no complaint had been filed within 60 days of the offense, as outlined in the AMS Constitution. March 23rd, the journal reported that the hearing had been delayed once again. The complaint requested to adjourn until September 1st because they needed time to seek independent counsel due to personal differences with the AMS prosecutor. The judicial committee chose to postpone the trial until September 24th. However, when it came to the scheduled date of the hearing, there was yet another problem. According to the journal, a court order from an Ontario Supreme Court judge ruled that the case would have to have been heard between March 15th and 30, 1990, As it stood, the defendants argued that the committee would be in contempt of court if they went ahead with the proceedings. On February 9th, the Journal reported that a plan was in place to build emergency phones by the following academic year. The legacy of these dedicated Queen's students and members of the community, particularly the women who protested, wrote letters, and conducted the sit-in, can be seen in the blue lights that helped to keep students safe to this day. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Oper Kingston's People History Podcast. For more information on the story, check out the transcript on the Oper Kingston website. If you would like to learn more from Operg about the People's History Project, or if you are interested in getting involved, follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Operg Kingston and stay up to date. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in to our next episode.